back to your lower anecdote.
Oh, yes. He said, now, Bob, if I look down at the floor like this, and he would show me, he'd drop his chin on his chest and look at the floor, and there's a pause. He said, you pick up for me. And I said, well, all right, Mr. Lowy. It happened many, many times when management was there. And never once did I say the wrong thing. I was always afraid that I would give the answer the wrong way or say something he didn't intend. But it always came off very nice.
Relationship is building at this point, is it not? Into a confidant. He trusted you and respected your abilities, too.
Now, of course, that happened after Gordon had left. In other words, I was in charge when when Gordon was there. We had some management shows, but it was primarily all the time Gordon was there. We didn't get up into full-size play at all. It was all small stuff, with the exception of the truck. Now, when the truck was done, Aloy was interested in the truck,
mm-hmm.
and we did that one in the 48 building, a full-size clay truck. In the 48 building. That's when we had moved from Sample Street, and Gordon was in charge part of the time, and X was in charge part of the time. But X was gone then. X was working directly for Roy Cole. And Gordon was still there.
Mm-hmm.
Or I don't know whether Gordon had left at that time. I don't know. He might have left right around in that time. Gordon and Lowy didn't see eye to eye on something, and Gordon took off, and he came to Ford, I do believe.
What time frame was that?
Well, that would be back in the, let's see. See, the truck, the R-Series truck, I got to think about this. We got to cut this in and out while I'm thinking.
Oh,
that's all. The R-Series truck, I think it came out in 49. It's in the book there.
Mm-hmm.
I have to go back and look at it. So,
right.
Yeah, backing up, 49, 48, just around the 47 is when Gordon got into a bind with Lowy and left, just
mm-hmm.
about the time. There was this fuss about the fact that Lowy thought, because he and X were close friends, that Gordon knew that X was doing a job in his basement. That was the whole idea of the thing. And he got mad at Gordon because Gordon didn't tell him that Exner was doing a job in the basement for the new champion line. And
just
so,
Lowy.
Yeah, Lowy. Yeah. Also, Cole had not given us the right dimensions on some of this stuff. You know, we were just really in bad shape. And then shortly after I had done the truck and the box components were done up at Murray, that's the back end,
mm-hmm.
the truck itself went from a quarter scale clay model right into wood.
Really?
Yep. And from the wood, didn't even paint the wood. It was shown in just mahogany form, you might say, and they put the blocks together and one thing and another, and everybody looked at it and said, go. And
yeah.
Cut the tools, and the truck was a smashing success.
Sure
they
was.
Sold more trucks back then than they ever thought they could, you know. And it was a good, sturdy truck. They got they built them all the way from quarter ton up to 2 tons, ton and a half, 2 ton. Pardon me while I clear my broken lungs. I'm still coughing from this wreck. I had all the ribs on this one side of me were crushed completely and with sections out of the middle of them. So I've got offset ribs. Every once in a while you'll see me squirm because they still hurt. And this side I had two or three ribs broken and I had a tube that they put down my throat into this lung, and they drilled a hole in this side and ran a tube in here, and I was having a hard time catching air, I'll tell you, for quite a number of weeks, and I hurt like hell for a long time, and I still, you know, I'll probably ache till the day I die, so what, it'd keep me awake.
And you seem recovered.
Oh yeah, I feel pretty good. I lost something like, what was it, 34, 35 pounds in the hospital. I never realized I could ever look so terrible, you know. It's nothing but like a walking skeleton, unbelievable.
Yeah.
But then I put it all back on. I think I've added another 20. So I'm lucky, and I feel pretty good, really. You know, I have no complaints. But okay, now we're back at this truck. Okay,
well,
now we got that
truck
wiped
is a
out.
Success,
yeah.
But you still had this incredible internecine warfare. It really got out of hand, didn't it?
Oh yeah, it did. Because then, when X was still there working for Lowy, I mean working for Roy Cole, Roy Cole threw the brakes into the Lowy group. This was really sad, in a way.
How could Roy do that?
He was a powerful guy. He was a tough guy.
He must have had Vance and Huffman's okay.
He must have, but in any case, it was a ridiculous thing. They threw us out of the 48th building after he had it all set up and moved us over to a dealership, Sherman, Shouse, and Freeman, two or three blocks away, close, but it was an automobile dealer, and took the second floor of this building and sectioned off about one-third of the second floor, and we were put in there. We had to walk through all the cars and the grease and everything else to get to the... And Johnny Reinhardt and Jack, the majority of these guys, we all got shoved into this place. This time, George Matthews was hired as a contact man between our group and engineering building on Sample Street. And George was a friend of Roy Cole's, but a hell of a nice man, just a gentleman, and a very talented guy, and a chassis man, actually. He and Gene Hartig, who was in charge of chassis engineering, worked together for years on equal basis in chassis engineering. And then George went with the Army during the war, and Gene stayed on at Studebaker during the war. Gene was crippled with arthritis all of his life. It's unbelievable what that man went through. It's an absolutely fantastic. Gene Hartig, H-A-R-D-I-G, just recently died down in Florida. But he stayed at Studebaker all of his life and did all the chassis work. He could draw like crazy, but he had this whole chassis department, did the trucks, did everything. And then after Studebaker folded up, he went with Nate Altman and Avanti as an engineer and an old guy, and did all of the Avanti work literally by himself, you know. Can you imagine? This guy was a real burner. Well, any case, okay, now we're sitting at Sherman, Shouse, and Freeman, Mitt Freeman.
Feeling a bit miffed by the whole thing.
Well, it didn't bother me too damn much. It's a funny thing. Isn't that strange? And at this point is when Tucker Matowick came to work. One day, after we were there knocking ourselves out, we would, for instance, we'd do a full-size clay model, then we'd get, if you can imagine this, we'd get at the last minute the fact that the car had to be 2.5 inches narrower, okay, and somewhat shorter by 2 inches or 3 inches, and you can't show it unless it's in the right dimensions, Roy would say to me, Roy Cole. Yes, sir, Mr. Cole. Now you better figure out what you're going to do, as it's, the car's too big. And then he'd stop out of the place and I'd say, yes, sir, Mr. Cole. And he'd scratch my head. And well, I was young and powerful and stupid. And I said, well, we'll get that guy. And so we'd take and we'd cut the plaster model. This is a plaster model. And so we had gone through the clay and it was real nice. It was just ready to be painted and all. He'd look at it and growl around the thing. So we'd take the plaster model and just take whatever we had to take out of it, 2 inches, 3 or 4 inches, and cut it, and then we'd put it together like this and then finish it off in the middle and redo the whole thing. And we'd do it in a matter of about 3 or 4 days, just working night and day, just unbelievable, just crazy stuff. So, all right, where am I now? Okay, so Johnny Reinhardt, Jack Aldrich, majority of guys, Bob Cotto, we barely had enough room to have boards for all of them to sit at. And like Cotto, for instance, he would be on the board part of the time. Most of the time, he just did clay modeling. And then they decided, Roy Cole decided that we should cut our numbers down. Things were getting tough. They had spent a lot of money on tooling and stuff, and they hadn't had a lot of income come in, I guess. And in any case, we had to cut the whole situation down by letting people go. And boy, that was tough. That was tough for me in particular. So Lowy takes a powder, and Barney takes a powder, and Bob, you're going to have to let these fellas go. And that's it. And so we give them a couple of weeks' notice or something like that, and that was it. And
who,
so
who did you have to cut?
Johnny Reinhardt came back to board. Jack Aldrich did, those two fellas in particular. Dick Khalil. Dick Khalil was just a fantastic Syrian fellow.
What were his skills in those days?
Dix? At that time, he primarily was a contact man between handling some of the stuff that George Matthews, who was a contact man between engineering and our group. Dick was not really what you'd call a proficient designer at that time. So he, in turn, did an awful lot of running between the two buildings and ironing out a problem here or finding out about this, that, or the other thing, or trying to locate this, that, you know, really a very important guy as far as helping the situation out. And then he could do just about anything as far as if we needed extra hands here to do this, that, and the other thing, he was there, you know. And he could do a certain amount of drafting and layout work. He was proficient and worth every nickel he made, so I had to let Dick go too. There were things I wanted to be able to let Dick do, and he wasn't there long enough for me to develop it for him.
Was this the incident of which the famous 49 Ford grew?
Yeah, just about in there.
Could you elaborate on that?
Sure.
I think you were probably one of the principal actors in the whole
thing. I had quite a bit to do with it, you know.
So what happened?
Well, what happened is this, that Johnny and Jack and the other fellows located jobs, but Dick wasn't very well known, I guess. They knew Johnny at Ford already, I think. And Jack, of course, at GM or Ford, and I think Jack came to Ford too. I don't know whether he went. No, I'm pretty sure he did. Not GM. Mm-hmm. Well, in any case, Dick didn't know what to do, and his wife Adelaide, she'll be there tonight, I guess. I haven't seen Addie for a long time. She was a nurse at the hospital in Mishawaka, and Dick married her while he was there, and they rented, I guess, this little house in Mishawaka. It was a small little frame house.
Mishawaka was the industrial suburb of South Bend.
That's right, directly east of South Bend. It was like a twin city, you might say. Yeah. They had a hell of a grand nightclub there with gambling in the back, too. That was interesting. It was called the L&H Inn. I'll never forget that. And you could go in there, and they literally fed you for nothing. Like for a dollar or something, they would put the full course meal on, and then you went into the back and you shot craps or something
like that.
You
lost it all.
Oh, you lost it all. Right. You paid for the dinner, but you didn't know it.
Yeah. Right.
Anyhow, so.
Did Dick have a daughter at this time?
No. Yes, he had a baby daughter.
Baby daughter, yeah.
You know, very small. Mm-hmm. Gosh, just a few minutes old, you might say, almost. But
that wasn't Mary Jo, was it?
Yeah, that's Mary Jo.
Mary Jo. Okay.
Yeah. And I haven't seen Mary Jo. I've talked to her on the phone a number of times. She was very excited about the fact that that the story came out in the book, I think, is one of the things of what actually happened. And I think her dad probably might have blown it out of sight to the degree that he did the whole darn thing. You know, well, it's just a normal type of thing that probably happens. And the way she sounded, it was like, so she tried to put me in a corner, like, who designed the thing? And all I could do is just sort of tell her, well, you know, it took a lot of people to get this thing off the ground and up to Detroit and so on. And your dad, he worked his butt off on it. And I didn't say exactly that, but he did. Everybody pitched in on it.
If you can give us some detail on that.
All right. Well, fine. So Dick came to me one day and he said, Bob, he said, I called up George Walker and I told George Walker who I was and where I was and that I was looking for work. And did he have any work that maybe I could do for him or something like that? And he said, George Walker, I guess he might have come up and talked to him direct. I don't know.
I think he did, yeah.
Yeah, he might have. And
didn't you originally recommend that he go there, as I recall?
Well, I told him just try anybody and everybody. And I don't know if he had gone to Ford and tried them and GM also, and also George Walker and or whatever.
Had you heard that they were working on the 49 Ford?
No, I had heard nothing.
Yeah.
We were completely out of sync with what was going on in Detroit at all times, you might say, and they didn't give a damn about us anyway, so in any case. So Dick came back this one day, and he was excited as heck, and he said, well, Bob, George Walker said this. He said, look, Dick, he said, I'll give you some dimensions of an automobile. He said, if you can make a quarter-scale model in a week's time or a week and a half or 2 weeks at the most and bring it up here and show it to me, and I like what you've done in that length of time, he said, I'll give you a job. And Dick is jumping up and down. He's a very excitable guy.
He's St. George's consultant to Ford, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Dick is jumping up and down. He's all excited as hell. And I look at Dick, and Dick is just a tremendous guy. He used to get the biggest kick out of him. He was so funny back in those days.
Uh-huh.
And such a bouncer.
Uh-huh.
And I said, "Now, be calm." He said, "Gee, you think that I could, you know, get a buck or some clay, or what could you do to help me, Bob?" And I said, "Now, just be calm. We'll get something together for you." I said, "You got to get a job. Your wife has got a new baby. And you're a good man, and George Walker should have you. So we'll get something put together, Dick." "Great, great. What can I do?" I said, "Now just relax. We'll get a buck. And we've got some wheels turned already, and we had some small bucks that would, let's see what the dimensions are." So he showed me the dimensions of the Ford. And
now, this was a package sketch, was it? Or a package?
No, it was just dimensions, like overall length, overall width, overall height, ground clearance to the ground, and, you know, size of wheels and tires, you know, those things. The position, also the seating position. In other words, it showed the position of where the steering column was and the steering wheel and the front seat and the rear seat. And there was a dimension back in here, a critical dimension in relation to headroom for the rear seat, right? They didn't have a call-off on tumble home on the car, but you knew you had to get the glass down in the doors, and the glass was flat glass. You've probably been all through this.
No. First time I've heard the whole story.
Well, in any case, so I got a hold of Larry Brom, who was Larry Brom is a woodworker. B-R-O-M, Larry Brom. Mm-hmm. And Larry's brother, Stan Brom, eventually came to work for me. And Stan worked at Ford, I think, after we closed down. Stan is still alive and in good health. Larry passed on finally. He was the older brother, too. Real nice guys. In any case, I told Larry, "Now look," I said, "go up there in the rack here, let's see what we've got in buck form. It'll suffice for this." And we had one that would work, and we put the wheels on the correct treads, front and rear, and the wheelbase. And Dick says, "Well, now where can I work it?" I said, "Well, you can't work it here." I said, "You just can't do that. You're going to have to take it home." What have I got? I said, "I don't know. What do you got in the kitchen? Wasn't I in your kitchen one time talking to you and Adelaide one night for a cup of coffee? And you had a table in the kitchen?" "Yeah, yep, I got a table in the middle of the kitchen. It was," I said, "with a formica top." And I said, "Does it look like it's pretty flat to you, Dick?" He said, "Yeah, as a matter of fact, it's got a nice top on it and it's strong." I said, "Okay, why don't you set the thing up on that table and check it out with a big straight edge here. Take this, borrow this big steel we've got, and see how good it is." Well, come to find out, that table was as good as our modeling tables. It was amazing, you know. And it was quite square, flush, and level. So, gosh, he took this thing and grabbed a hold of it, and we finally got the thing. And I think overnight the next morning he had the thing, and then he had to get some clay, and he got some boxes of clay. "I'll get this all back to you, Bob. I'll give you the money for this." I said, "Don't worry about it, Dick. I think we can afford it, you know." And he said, "No, I'll get it back to you. I'll pay you for this." I said, "No, that's all right." He said, "I'll weigh it. I know how much it costs. And it's Chavant clay, and it's so much a pound and all," because he had ordered some for him. Well, he probably did pay me back. I just could just bet you he did, but I can't remember for sure. But in any case, I didn't press that at all. And so he took it home and then put the clay in his wife's oven carefully, and it stunk the house up just good, heating it, you know what I mean?
The old Chavant sulfur clay.
Yeah, right. And we didn't have any electric boxes. The other thing you do is you take a cardboard box, for instance, turn it upside down, put a light bulb in there, you know, and that will do a pretty good job over a period of time. So to get the thing clayed up, we heated it in her oven, and I don't think she was too thrilled with that, but she's a very pleasant lady.
Now, who were involved? Who'd you
recruit
for the job?
All right. The book, there's one man that I didn't mention in the book, and that's Joe Thompson. I should have. Joe Thompson was another fellow that Gordon brought in. If you come tonight, I'll have some stuff, that, you know, pictures of these guys that are up on the screen,
great.
Slide form. If not, I could, well, I think they're in the book, as a matter of fact. So it's really not important for you to knock yourself out getting over there, but if it'd be nice if you could.
I think I will.
You know, you just might. Bring your wife, too.
Okay.
Anyhow, so the guys that worked on her, Johnny Lutz, Let's see if I can hit him off. Joe Thompson, who was really, actually, he was one of the first modelers hired by John Lutz's father at General Motors. And John Lutz's father taught Joe Thompson. And Joe Thompson literally taught young Johnny, because old man had passed on when young John Lutz was beginning to get into the modeling business, and young John Lutz ended up here at Ford, and he was one of the best damn models. He worked on the Continental Mark II with Johnny Reinhardt, I believe, from what I've heard anyway. Well, let's see. So, John Lutz. John Bird, who is the chief modeler at General Motors for quite a number of years, and he came up from zero. John Bird, it's funny, I was talking to Gordon the other night. Gordon said, you know, I hired John Bird. I said, you did? He said, yeah. And I had to stop and think, because I was always of the impression I had hired John Bird. Isn't that funny? So I didn't say anything to Gordon, you know. And any case, Gordon and I had nothing to say for or, you know, against John Bird, and we both, I just listened to Gordon, and John Bird came in right off of the farm. He had never had any experience in anything like this, and the guy came in. He was skinny as a rail, just a young guy, not married or anything, and he had one desperately crippled hand. And it was like this, you know, a claw hand of this nature. And it was obviously an accident. And he came in, and I put my hand out, and he puts his hand right out. It was his right hand, and I shook his hand, and he sat down. He didn't say anything. I looked at him, and he said, I'd like to work for you. And I might have been Gordon, but maybe I was sitting there when it was done, when he hired him. But I do remember what John Bird said. So I could have, if Gordon hired him, yeah, in the final analysis, I was at the point when John was first interviewed. You might say that. And maybe Gordon did hire him. But in any case, and I said, well, fine. I said, can you do anything in wood? Yes, he said, I'm pretty good working wood. He said, I do carpentry work and things like that. And I could see that the kid was smart, with his answers were quick and crisp. And I said, did you ever hear of clay? I said, we make automobile forms with clay here. No, he didn't know anything about that, but he was sure he could handle it. And then he said, well, you probably wonder with my bad hand whether or not I can. He said, I can work with this hand. I can hold tools. I can do anything with it. It looks bad. I said, well, that's really, if you can work with it and you feel comfortable with it, I said, it's no problem with us at all, John. And I said, how in the world did you have your accident? He said, well, it's a very stupid thing. When I was very young, down on the farm, I came from a poor farm, he said, and we had to go out and shoot rabbits sometimes to get something to eat on the table. I had a shotgun, and my father, who was killed in an accident, had warned me as a little kid that certain things I shouldn't ever do, and this day I did what I was not supposed to do. And he said, I crawled under a barbed wire fence, left my shotgun on the other side of the fence, and as I crawled through, the thing was cocked, and I pulled the shotgun through with my right hand, and the shotgun went off, and it literally blew his arm apart, you know what I mean? And cut all the tendons and everything else. Well, then they didn't have good doctors, you know, and they couldn't get him to the farm. It was just a case of wrapping everything up, stopping the blood, and hoping that the kid made it. It was terrible. And I remember another kid on a farm that I knew. I used to help my widowed aunt down in southern Illinois. This kid was caught in a barn fire. They didn't know what to do about severe burns in those days. And he, in turn, they bandaged up his arm in a position like this. His name was Murphy, I'll never forget, Pat Murphy. And the skin bridged, and he had a web between here and here, and he was completely scarred, one ear gone, and all of that sort of thing. Unbelievable. You know, the things that went on back in those days, just terrible.
So John came in, and who else was on the team?
All right, now we're back at Dick Khalil's kitchen.
Right.
Bob Cotto, of course, he was there. And of course, Dick, yeah, Bob was modeling and also contributing to the shape of the body, mm-hmm. you might say, around the windows and things like that, which is a normal state of affairs. I had made some sketches for the car, mm-hmm. not to get into the details of the thing. The front end of the car, of course, you can see on really in 1940, and so I was putting spinners on stuff right. because of the aircraft, you know.
You were the original just, spinner.
I was a spinner freak. You know
right. right.
Anyhow.
Because of your aviation background.
Yeah, I guess so.
So you decided to resurrect that. First, you'd use the variation of it,
To a degree. I thought, well, you know, what are we going to do here? I know this front end will work because I've been drawing it for years.
Right.
And so I said, well, you know, the heck, let's take a job. I didn't figure the thing would be anything but put on a shelf and he'd go to work.
Right.
That's crazy. So basically,
you set the dimensions and, or I mean, the design.
The theme of the car.
The theme of the car.
Yeah,
the
more or less.
Original sketches.
Right. Yeah.
Any of those sketches were left, by the way?
No, not really, you know. The car had vertical taillights mm-hmm. instead of the horizontals.
Mm-hmm.
They had the fairing strip and the horizontals is the way it was built.
Right.
And there was a detail difference as far as the blade in the that comes off of the spinner detail in the front. Spinner detail is pretty close on,
mm-hmm.
and the framing around the top of the spinner, not around. And I had, I think, shown FORD fielded. On the sheet metal rather than being part of the chrome, which is sort of a dumb thing because although it showed Ford a lot stronger, it was costly to do. They had to put the letters on separately.
Yeah, right.
Rather than put them, stamp them into the header detail, header framing. The horizontal blade went out and over, wrapped over the frame, rather than terminating inboard of the frame like it did on the Ford, I do believe.
Mm-hmm.
There's a picture in there that was a resurrection. Let's see what that looks like. And the details, I think, are all there, the way it was put together. Well, there's the Ford there, and there's Dick. Yeah. Yeah, they took it out over.
Mm-hmm.
And the one I did was, the one I did was inboard here.
Mm-hmm.
You'll notice another thing, that this car is basically rounder and fuller looking than what we showed them in a model for.
Really?
Yeah. And the difference actually shows up, but it's basically the same car. I don't know, where's the picture of the sketch in here? Yeah, you can see that this was a flatter sided,
right.
straighter car.
Uh-huh.
And it ended up a rounder, which is, you know, made it look stronger, you might say. And that was done at Ford.
That was done at Ford.
Oh, yeah.
Presumably by their stylist.
I would say so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But basically, that's the way it looked.
It came out pretty close to your original
sketch. Oh, yeah. I'll say the hood details, the front end look, the way the windows looked and all. It's not too far off, really. Anyhow, so let's see. And so we finally got the thing all. Joe Thompson did a lot of surfacing work on it. He's not mentioned in that book, unfortunately. And Joe is dead now. But a hell of a guy.
Photo worked on the slab sides, you said elsewhere,
yeah.
I think.
In relation to, you mean flush sides?
Yeah, the flush sides. Right.
Yeah, well, yeah, Bob worked on the sides, and he worked on the roof, and he worked on the windshield, the window details, and one thing at the front, back, and so on. I kept an eye on everything. I'd go over at night and take a look, see how things were going, and make
mm-hmm.
suggestions, and sometimes get in on it, a little clay work myself, and the front end detail was primarily me. The hood was primarily me. Dick worked all the way around, and Dick did a lot of finishing work on the car all the way around and all sides of the car, and
mm-hmm.
I'd say that he contributed as much to that thing as anybody, if not more.
Mm-hmm.
And if it wasn't for Dick, it would never, you know, it was a real shock to me when that thing showed up on the road. It was really a shocker.
It must have been.
Oh, gosh.
But for your guys, it was just helping out a friend.
Yeah, that's all it was. And it wasn't a terrible amount of work. It was a few nights of heavy going, you
really?
Know, trying
it was
to get
all down
the
kitchen. You never went down to the basement.
Never to the basement.
No,
I don't think the house had a basement in it.
Oh, yeah, right.
I don't think it. I think
yeah.
it was on piles, you know.
Mm-hmm,
and
right.
Then they had this lattice work underneath. And
Who did the plaster mold? How did that come about?
plaster mold for what?
For this, or was that done in?
That was all, this thing went up to.
As it was, went up to.
In clay.
Went up in clay.
In clay, sitting on the rear seat of Dick's car.
Really?
Yep.
It was a fourth.
It was about a quarter scale.
Quarter scale.
Yeah, but we did that on occasion. We did that once in South Bend. We did a, the heck was it? It's a, an English car. It was a Hillman, not a Hillman. It was a Sunbeam, Sunbeam Talbot, two-door speedster, roadster, you might call it.
Uh-huh, right.
The louvers on the hood, and we did that whole car in clay, uh-huh, in South Bend. You know, we had some extracurricular stuff going on when time was available. And put that in the back seat of my car, and I drove the thing to New York with Kurt Bohm. I'll never forget that. And brought it up to Loewy's office, Kurt Bohm, B-O-E-H-M. It was a design. So that sort of thing was sort of common.
Standard
procedure. Usually when we deliver it, like for instance in this particular case, you take and you wash it down with turpentine and slick it a little bit after you get it there to take any of the dents and stuff out of it. But it'll hold up quite good if it's got a good buck underneath it. Yeah.
Dick went off with this in the back seat of his car
and delivered it to Walker. And
did he ever report back to what happened?
Oh, sure. Boy, he was excited. He came back, I think, the same day or the next day or something like that. And he said, "I got the job, Bob." He called me up on the phone. I said, "Great." And I was just pleased as punch.
Oh,
so he was too. And I don't know how long, many years he was with Walker, just a few, I think, and then he went to Chrysler, I do believe.
Mm-hmm.
And once in a while I'd touch base with him or hear from him. And
I think he came back after that.
Came back to.
I'm not sure he came back to Ford or not.
Did he ever work at Ford? I just don't know.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Dick did.
Yeah, Dick did. And George made good his promise because this was a fabulous thing he brought.
Yeah. Well, there's
a Dick represented, I'm afraid, that he,
yeah,
his part a little bit stronger than it might have been.
Well, yeah, I'm sure. Any case, that was only normal, you might say. What the heck? As I understand it, we heard that George Walker, and I don't know how true this is, showed Ford two clay models. And George Walker told Ford the fact that this is the car they should build because two completely different design groups made these two models and they both looked the same. Two quarter scale models that both looked the same, both had the same front ends and details and everything else, and this is the way Ford should go. And it's impossible that you two completely separated people could come up with the same quarter scale model. I mean,
what would be your educated guess as what did happen?
What did happen is literally that, and George Walker sold that particular design to Ford. Actually, George Walker sold the design to Ford, just like Loewy sold certain things to Studebaker.
But it was your group's design.
I would say so, without a doubt.
You had indicated earlier there was some rounding.
Well, yeah, that's the only thing I can say is that the body is, you know, just rounded out a little bit more than the way that our model looked. Our model was a little stiffer.
Yeah.
I don't, Bob Cotto, if he saw it, he'd say, no, I think ours was just as round as that, and I know it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah,
you know,
sure,
that's the way it goes. So I'd say that certainly, again, in relation to George Walker, in relation to Raymond Loewy, if it wasn't for a George Walker and it wasn't for a Raymond Loewy, there were a lot of things that would have never seen the light of day.
Right, exactly.
But the fact that the design originated in South Bend and one man got a job out of it was enough for me, you know
sure
what I mean?
Right. And you had a certain amount of satisfaction seeing your
Oh, self-satisfaction.
Coming at you.
Oh,
coming
yes,
at you in
absolutely.
Great numbers.
Right. Memories all the way back to E.M. Laird, you know?
Yeah, right.
Well, let's see, from there, where do we go?
Well, you're You're gonna do the 50 coupe was something of a compromise, was it not? Or was that a completely new vehicle?
How is our time? Is it 5 minutes to 11?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's see. The 50 coupe was a compromise in that, or the 50 sedan.
Yeah.
In that originally, there might even be a picture in the book. I think there is. Originally, we had modified the cowl and put this fillet up to the windshield, lowering the top of the hood,
mm-hmm.
and coming through with a much more graceful hood and a much more graceful front end in which to put this crazy spinner.
Right.
And at the last minute, Roy Cole let us work ourselves to death with this filleted, lowered cowl.
Uh-huh.
In the last minute, he said, "That's out. You can't do that. You've got to change that. Put that cowl right up where it was originally."
Uh-huh.
And I said, "Well, Mr. Cole, something must have happened because we got an okay to do it at one time." "Yes, I know that, Bob, but you have to change it. We can't afford that. I found out we just can't afford to do it." And it's very possible it did happen. So we did. We cut the darn thing, or we had cut it down, and we put the cowl back up exactly the way it was, and then took the hood off of that, and everything got more bulbous, and it didn't work out too good with the design. I was pretty happy with it originally.
Yeah,
and so,
geez.
And in that regard, that particular car was shown in conjunction with a job that X did. And they chose our car, they chose our design over the one X did.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Now, in all honesty, I will say that the one that X did was a highly saleable machine.
Mm-hmm.
And would have been, I'd say, on an equal basis with the one that they accepted that we did, as far as sales would be concerned, as far as Studebaker sales in 1950, which was an up year anyway.
Yeah.
And the 1950 car that we did in the up year, they built and sold more Studebakers that year of the spinner nose than any other year previous or after that. That was the highest production year for Studebaker. I read an article not just too long ago, a few weeks ago, somebody had a misconcept on that thing, and they quoted the total sales figures wrong, and it was the 50 was the highest selling car. It sold 500 and some odd thousand, you know, and towards the end they were selling like 27,000 cars a year. But and then there were a lot of trucks on top of that, and they were still doing army work, you know, 4x4s and stuff like that.
It was still a exciting design, even so, right? I thought
it's outstanding from the standpoint. It didn't look like anything else.
That's it. Yeah, you had a clear field there.
Yeah, right. But as far as pure aesthetic quality is concerned, I think it was a far cry from anything quite like that.
Typical being designed by a committee. I mean, having the design changed by from above.
Yeah, right. Well.
Well, has X departed by this time? By 50? Is he still in Roy Cole's basement?
No, he's working right over in on Sample Street.
Oh, I see.
The only thing he did in his own basement was the 47. And then he's back on the surface of things over in the Sample Street Engineering Building.
That's right, you guys are still over in the...
We're still at Sherman Charles Mitt Freeman.
Yeah, dealership.
Yeah.
But Louis is working his way back in the good gracious management.
Well, yeah, that car, the 50 that they chose over X's job, it gave X the clue, and God bless him, it was a good clue, that Roy Cole wasn't strong enough to swing him.
Yeah.
And over Lowy, he just wasn't.
Yeah.
And it wasn't X's fault at all, because X is a very capable, you know, hardworking guy.
Right.
And I might say he was a hard-drinking guy, too. Holy smokes, the gosh, he was something else. As a young fella, he was wild. But he was there on the job every morning, bright and early, and he didn't ever walk. He ran from one place to another. You know,
uh-huh.
He was just a real banger.
Uh-huh.
Terrific guy, nice guy. In any case, and a hard-working guy. I had a lot of respect for X. In a different way in which I had respect for Lowy, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I had respect for both of the men. And Gordon, terrific.
In their own way, they were all three superior people.
Oh, sure. Yeah, great guys. Well, let's see where I'm at. So now, at this point, that is the one that convinced X he ought to go elsewhere, and
right.
He got this terrific job with Chrysler, and he had one hell of a time with Chrysler, you know, and he did a lot of good work for them.
Certainly did.
And probably
in the 20th century. Really.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then he had all these Italian cars that
uh-huh.
he, you know, special automobiles, and boy, it was like, to me, it seemed like that boy, he was just in a spot there that was like heaven. You know, he must have really enjoyed himself. And he worked for this, who was the president of Chrysler at that time? fellow that sort of got into trouble?
Texas at Cobra.
That's right.
Yeah.
He got into some kind of trouble, or one of his purchasing agents did, or some dumb thing. I forget what the...
Yeah, his president. Huh? Bill, what was his name, who was taking rake-offs from the supplier.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Gosh, you know, in retrospect, well, that's another story. Hold that back.
Anyhow, go ahead. The X is gone, then. So the lawyer group's got a clear field.
Right. And so at just about that time, we had outgrown the Sherman Shaw's Freeman. That was a real hole. It was bad. It was bad heating, and it was hotter than hell in the summertime. It's an oven in the summer and just a frigid spot in the wintertime, and it was nasty. So then they moved us out to the Chippewa plant, and we had a nice section right in the very front of the building in a large, big layout.
Is that Chippewa Street?
We call it the Chippewa plant. It's Chippewa Street, Indian name. Ran east and west.
How far from the main plant was it?
Well, from Sample Street Engineering Building, and that's the one I used to spend most of my time at, Sample Street Engineering Building was about a half a mile at the most, or a little bit over a quarter of a mile from the administration building, and the production buildings were in between four and five story old brick buildings where they used to build the cars.
Yeah.
And behind the Sample Street building was a foundry, and Studebaker had one of the most up-to-date modern foundries in the country for a year, in the world, as a matter of fact, at one point. And the Chippewa plant was about 3.5 miles south of the Sample Street building, and right in almost a dead line with it, but way south, and that was a big plant that was built for the war effort, you might say, trucks, and eventually, as I said, they tested jet engines in there and that sort of thing. I think some certain Weasel components were made, although the Weasel never saw the light of day as far as getting into the war, but that was quite an interesting vehicle, by the way. That's the one vehicle that H.E. Churchill was very proud of, is the Weasel.
Mm-hmm. Was it an all-terrain vehicle?
It was an all-terrain vehicle in that it was terrain and water, both. And tracks on it, and one thing and another. And it was actually a people carrier. It wasn't a fortified vehicle. And it was built light to the degree that they could put it in transport carriers, and they could parachute it, drop it, you know. And it was a hell of a vehicle. It had a Champ engine in it, a flathead, a little underpowered. I think they got it up to about 186 cubic inches. Increased the cubic inches on it, and I think they adapted, it's the first time they adapted overhead valves to the old Siamese cylinder, cast cylinder Champion engine, which, by the way, the original Champion engine developed more horsepower for its cubic inch displacement than any other internal combustion engine. Barney Roos developed that engine way back with Roy Cole and Gene Hardy many years ago.
They used it for years, didn't they?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. At this point, do you have a mandate for a completely new model that you've got to come up with, maybe in a couple
years?
Yeah,
let's see. All right, now we moved out to the Chippewa plant. It's 50. And then we started doing facelifts, and we did the 51, which was a terrible-looking spinner job. It had a transparent plastic spinner inside of God, there were some terrible looking cars.
Who ducked you into that?
Well, we had, pardon me, this is an aftermath of my crash. Every once in a while, I have to clear my lungs a little bit.
Transparent spinner.
Yeah, that particular item was just one of many, you might say, and I really can't say who it was, but we had directives. From time to time I remember that transparent spinner started out, somebody thought it'd be neat to put a light behind it. And I talked them out of that, and we painted it with opaque silver because, you know, they're ready for production.
Sure.
It would have been really crazy, and I think that was brought about by the fact that somebody was impressed with the Tucker or something, or you know, Cyclops eye type of thing. A single headlight on a locomotive. And so that was 51. 52. All right, so we facelifted him through, and right about that time, 1950, and 51 was the first time that Studebaker had a V8 engine. Mm-hmm. And that was a catastrophe. They had a terrible time. They kept eating up camshafts. And just many millions of dollars, and Studebaker never ever gave any of the customers any problem. If they had made a mistake, they'd carry it to the ground and replace it forever. Mm. So I think it cost them at the time about $4 million to get it straightened out and the repair of cars all over the country. And it was really, well, there's a couple of big long stories about it, and I have a complete one, and that's another story completely, what was wrong with it and how they corrected it, and they had a hell of a time straightening the thing out. But one of the problems was that they could not get the particular metal that they wanted to grind the crankshafts, camshafts with. And they treat the metal after they've ground them and so forth and so on. Well, it was a real hairline fine thing of a different grind, a different type of heat treating and all of that, and also the spring tensions on the valves and the spring tensions on the this, that, and the other. Well, anyway, they got it finally ironed out and turned out to be a real good engine, but it cost them an awful lot of money. All right, so now we're 1950, 51 we're talking about, and then 52 came along and facelifting some more, and we needed new cars and pretty bad. Mm-hmm. And so the pressure was on to come up with a new, all new sedan, and we worked on these, and there are some pretty horrible examples of all new sedans that we did up into full size and quarter scale, and everybody was pushing clay and quarter scale, and I was running around from one guy's modeling table to the next trying to keep things in line, and then we were building the full-size clay model cars there, which in turn we made big bucks, and then we put the surface plates around just like they do today, same type of thing, and you'd go around there, and we had clay ovens. We actually made ourselves the clay ovens, or had constructed over in the metal shop.
Electric ovens?
They were electric, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we made the clay extruder. Yeah. And the clay extruder, we had all kinds of dies for moldings and things of that nature. Right. And we'd pack this thing just like packing an old musket with this lumps of clay, turn the heat on, let it heat up real good. And we had this big worm, push this stuff out. And boy, we used to have, and we had long boards, and some fellow would feed the stuff out on the boards. And then we'd take the whole board, you know, and there were days of moldings and and frames for windows and stuff. Well, in any case, we started to build cars and one thing and another.
But you had your own molds, that was good. It's for precast molds that were standard sizes and the standard
dies. So the die shapes, of course, they were literally hand filed out of say quarter inch plate, then they were all, held in with a great big frame type of thing with nuts and bolts on it and T-handles, and oh boy, it had some great stuff. Mm-hmm. And now where are we? Well, okay, we're endeavoring to come up with a new body style, basic four-door and two-door sedan.
Somebody decided you needed a real fresh design. Right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And in that regard, what we were doing, I wasn't too happy with it. The proportions of the car were not all that great originally. And the other thing that they wanted to do, they wanted to start to promote a little bit. And of course, General Motors and Ford and Chrysler had show cars when the showtime came around for the big automobile international shows and so on. And Lowy convinced them that I was always trying to convince Lowy to ask management to put some money out. This is a very difficult time, as they just lost $4 million on bad engines. Mm-hmm. And management agreed to make put the money out to develop a show car. So that's when the 53 hardtop series started up. And there were four guys, Bob Cotto, myself, Don Bruce, and Vince Gardner. I set them aside to have, with about a week and a half to 2 weeks, to finish up quarter-scale models, just let them have a free hand, and I'd walk around and watch what they were doing and try to keep an eye on it and all that kind of stuff. So we made these quarter-scale models, and they were all of them, I'd say at this point. There were certain aspects of them on my model that looked somewhat like the one that went into production, but not all of it. It was different. It had the quarter scale had a kick up for the rear fender in the back rather than a straight through line like it ended up on the in the full size. Uh-huh. And that car actually got up to full size on my half of the car. And Bob Cotto, Lowy, and Barney, and I looked at all the models and decided what looked best. Mm-hmm. Well, Bob Cotto, you know, he was a damn good modeler and he had a pretty darn good eye on certain things. Mm-hmm. And what Vince had done and what Don Bruce had done didn't come off to their thinking. And what Cotto had done and what I had done, they sort of liked, and they thought that that was what we should get up in full size as fast as we could. Mm-hmm. So we started out. And Bob Cotto worked his butt off, and I worked my butt off, and he was a bit older than I was, and he couldn't go quite as hard as I could go 3 days in a row with no sleep. I was really? That crazy, yeah, wow. Just crazy. And so aside from watching the other guys with the regular stuff going on, there were changes on trucks, and they were trying to come up with regular sedans, which are the bread and butter of the thing. I spent most of my time at night, or when I could, working on this show car, so-called, type of thing.
Right.
And it went through one phase, so when I stood back and looked at that thing after working my butt off on the thing, I said, this is just not the way it's going to be, you know, ever. Mm-hmm. It was a decent-looking car, but not the way I wanted it to look. Mm-hmm. So Lowy was gone a good part of the time. He didn't even see, I think he saw the first do on the thing that I didn't like too much, and I talked to him on the phone one day, and I told him, I want to change it and change it completely because I have a thought that it's just not the way we should go. And all he said was, okay, Bob, go ahead. Do you think you can get it done in time? I said, I'm bound to. I said, it has to be done. Well, go ahead, Bob. And with that, he went to Europe, and he was gone for quite a number of weeks. And when he came back, the car was done. And full size side was all done. I had gone through a couple of stages with it, too, as you see tonight, maybe. Well, I think they're in the book, where I had to modify it as a show car. I was still on the pretext that it was going to be a show car, so I had made some rather extreme things for a production car, in that the taillights were to be made of bumper stock. Well, Cadillac did that actually later on.
Uh-huh.
And the back end of the car, the bumper was shaped in relation to the deck lid that came down, and the bumper was a projection out here and then went in underneath the car like this, and the taillights had a back angle on them, and they in turn were bumper guards. So the car was protected, but it would cost like a fortune with a Studebaker's money. If it was a Cadillac or something like that, it could be done, but not with Studebaker's bucks. So I went through phases like that. The other thing that you'll see or notice, I think, or maybe it's in the book, is that the door, like the Camaro Firebird, had a one-piece glass for the full length of the door.
Uh-huh.
You about there?
Yeah, go ahead.
And there was no quarter window in the back, so it was a door of a given size with one piece of glass that went down forward like this, and no quarter window on the original car. Mm-hmm. And a huge door, and that door at that time was about the size of a Camaro door today. Mm-hmm. But they wouldn't buy that either. So I had to. And the reason I changed it immediately was the fact that I got a tip from Vance one night. He'd come over at night sometimes,
mm-hmm.
and he smelled of a very high quality of scotch. But he'd come over, and he liked to just walk around very quietly and absorb it. He was a hell of a nice man and a very intelligent guy. And he'd say very little to me. He'd just look at it. Once in a while, he'd ask a question, but never a difficult one. He never got me excited. And then this one night he said to me, well, Bob, he said, as I recall, it sounded just like this. Well, Bob, he's a big, tall guy. He said, I want you to do something for me. I looked up and I said, what's that, Mr. Benson? He said, I want you to watch the costs on this thing, the detailed costs. And of course, I knew what he meant, the difficulty of stamping the fenders, this, that, and the other thing. And the depth of draw, just watch it. I said, all right, Mr. Vance, I will. And from that time on, I thought to myself, God, the guy's got something in his mind. It's more than a show car, if he's really concerned about that, because it wouldn't make any difference as a show car. Mm-hmm. Then I really began to sweat. I wanted that car to be as good as ever. Mm-hmm. And I was excited, jeez.
At this point, was there a little friendly competition between you and Bob? Kodo?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
you
there was
both
that.
Only one side.
Right? Yeah, he had, now Kodo had his other side going, and Bob at night, he wouldn't spend much time at night. And he had, I forget what the combination was. I recall it at one time. Which fellas worked on Bob Kodo's? I know Hugh Bush was one of them, and I think Fred Horning worked on Bob Kodo's side. Mm-hmm. And the guys that could work at night, if Johnny Lutz had a little booze in him, he'd be fine. Uh-huh. Johnny Bird and Johnny Lutz and myself primarily, and then there was a little help from, say, Victor Clark and Larry Brahm's brother, Stan Brahm. Once in a while, the guys that could come in spent a little time at night, and they didn't get paid a nickel. They didn't get any overtime.
No.
You know, it was just, I never got paid overtime for anything, and I used to work always Saturdays,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes on Sundays, I'd go in for 2-3 hours.
Uh-huh.
And practically every night, I go home to dinner, get up from the table, and go back to work.
Incredible. And 10 o'clock
at night.
Forbearing.
Well, she really went out of her mind a few times, I must say. You know how women get. They get very excited.
Yeah.
And she was Italian and German, and she would get excited. There's no doubt about it.
Well, so you've got these two sides pretty much.
Yeah, now Bob Kodo's side, it was coming along, and I'd go around and try to help him a little bit here and there and so forth. I didn't want to tell him what to do because he was my assistant and an older man than I was. And so I let him fly and do the best he could, and he did come up with some pretty nice ideas here and there.
Mm-hmm.
He worked on his side specifically 100%. And that, on my side, at one point, it had a slope back opening, a regular grill opening in the front of the hood,
mm-hmm.
and out of that slope back opening was a spinner.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. I think you might see that. I don't know if that'll be there in the slides tonight, but you might see it,
uh-huh.
catch it in the early stage.
Uh-huh.
And then it went into the split grill. That is the split grill, like it ended up. And that's the pitch that Pontiac has used for years. You know, they split the grills.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure, they swiped it.
And I don't know if they swiped it or not. I might have swiped it from somebody, but who, I don't know.
Turned out beautiful.
Well, anyhow.
Did you have a final judging then?
Actually, at one point, there were the two sides of the car.
Yeah.
And here again, it was left up to Lowy. He was the boss, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Right, yeah.
And he walked around the thing.
Lowy and Vance?
No, just Lowy. Just Lowy and Barney Barnhart.
Barnhart, yeah.
Yeah. And they looked around it and walked around it, and I didn't say a word. I just kept on working on one thing and another. I didn't even offer to say anything. I wanted to see what they were going to say.
Sure.
And they came up with a conclusion, so Lowy called me off to one side, and he says, Bob, he says, there's no comparison between the two sides. The side you've got here is the side we want to go with. And I said, well, I thought maybe that's what you'd end up with. Of course, Kodo was disappointed, but he could see it coming, literally, because even though he might not have admitted it to himself, he could see that the one side was a hell of a lot better looking, or fresher looking, you might
right.
say.
Yeah.
Anyhow, that was it, and then off and running like crazy, and boy, then we really got into it and finished it up and made modifications in it for production and everything else. And I told Lowy at the time that, you know, that Mr. Vance drops over here at night by the time we did. Has he seen this? He said, Bob. And I said, yes, he's seen both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what does he like, Bob? He said, I said, he's never said anything. Whether he liked this side or that side, all he said to me was, Bob, watch the cost. He said that? I said, yes. And then he said, Barney, you hear that? You know, he'd shake his head like this. And Barney said, yeah. Barney was all excited, too.
Uh-huh.
So the next thing we knew, we had the car ready to show management.
Mm-hmm.
and management consisted of Vance, Hoffman, and primarily the moneylenders from New York.
Who was the second one? Vance and?
Paul G. Hoffman.
Hoffman, I'm sorry.
And the moneylenders from New York, and there were about four or five of them. The big banks in New York that kept the place afloat.
Right, yeah. God knows how.
Oh, boy. So, the day arrived, and at this time, we had also a four-door sedan and a two-door sedan out in the front area, the main area that we did the cars in, and then in this back, we call it the showroom, but we did more work back there. Back there was where the hardtop series was, or the 53. And I can recall that the powers-to-be walked around the sedan cars, and they were just clay color, you know, and blacked-out windows, and everything that was chrome was had foil on it.
Uh-huh.
And they looked quite presentable. They walked around there, and at one point Vance turned to me, and he said, Bob, is the show car in the back, is it presentable? Can we look at that? And I said, yes, Mr. Vance, we got it cleaned up pretty well. He said, well, fine. He said, well, let's go in there. He said, so I walked to the back and opened a pair of doors, and they all walked in there, and I stood off to one side. Then Lowy stood off to one side, and I sort of stood with Lowy and Barney. And Vance and Hoffman walked around, and all these guys, they got in little groups, and they talked. And they were there a long time. And then Vance turned to Lowy and Hoffman, and they said, he said, well, Raymond, he said, we have to go back now. Thank you very much. And that's all that was said, and they all trailed out of the place. Mm. Lowy looked at me, and I looked at him. Nothing had been said.